I think that nobody can say I'm going to use the stream of consciousness as my method for writing. That's wrong. He's getting into trouble. He must use that simply as a tool. Only when nothing else will do the work. It's much better to show the character in familiar terms of action or speech, but sometimes that's not sufficient. Then you have to use another tool, just as at times the carpenter realizes that his familiar tools are not quite enough to do what he wants to do, so he's got to stop and make something. Make a tool.
Mr. Faulkner?
Yes, ma'am.
The New York Times spoke of your brooding concern for people. Were you born with that brooding concern for the human being, or does that develop as you adulthood approaches, or when did this brooding concern happen?
Now, I think that's a question you should ask the man who wrote the piece in the New York Times. But I don't think I have any brooding concern for people. I like people, but there's no brooding concern about it.
You don't feel that you have a brooding concern?
I didn't know I had until this man told me, but I think people are something that one doesn't need to brood about. People are interesting. They are the most interesting, diverting thing on earth. It's fun to watch people and wonder why they do what they do, not to brood over them. Of course, one has got to be concerned over man's condition, because if a man is to advance, he must take cognizance of man's condition to improve it. But you don't brood over it, you do something about it. When you see injustice, you raise your voice and state that this is bad or don't like it, but you don't brood over it. Yes, sir.
Sir, why is it that most of your short stories and hunting stories are so clear and simple, like the one you just read? Yet, some of your novels that you think are your finest seem to have to be so mixed up psychologically, and that they're hard for the average reader to understand.
Well, that is something like the first question we had. The story commands its own method of telling it. Some stories can be told quite simply and objectively, like this little boy's reactions to the adult world that he had to cope with. Other stories demand more probing into what makes men and women tick. That is, this little boy could show what made him tick by his simple speech and action. There are other times when the action and the speech won't show that, so the craftsman's got to dig around to find some other method to use to show what he hopes to tell. And it's not that the ones I like are the ones in which I've done which I'm obscure. They are the ones that have caused me the most trouble. I think none of the books that any writer does are quite good enough. That's why he writes another one. The ones that he labors the hardest over, worries the most about, he develops the same affection for that the parent does for the unfortunate child, the sick child, or the mentally unbalanced child. But they all are failures in his opinion, because they are not as good. He don't want to be as good as his coevals, or even just as good as Shakespeare. He wants to be better than Shakespeare and Homer. He knows he can't, but that's what he works for. That's what makes a writer's life such a happy one. He always has something to get up tomorrow that he's anxious to do, which is to attain the impossible, never to reach satiety, always to have something a little beyond his reach, but still to jump at it, to try. That to any mother, the child is a genius no matter what he does, and I suspect that to any father, a boy that shows no inclination to be anything but a tramp is not much of anything to him, never will be. But I think that probably the writer is being a writer from the time he begins to observe, long before he learns to spell. It's sometimes a man or woman begins to write at an early age, sometimes they wait until middle age, even late in life.
But did you write very early?
Yes, but not seriously. I never thought of taking up writing as a serious trade until I met Mr. Sherwood Anderson in New Orleans. And I liked him at once. We would meet in the afternoon. I had other jobs then, but I would be all the time. We would walk around New Orleans. He would talk, and I would listen. We would meet in the evening and go to a courtyard, and he would talk, and I would listen until 12 or 1 o'clock over a bottle of whiskey. The next morning, he would be in seclusion, working. I wouldn't see him till afternoon. Then we would walk, and I would listen, and he would talk, and we would talk and laugh again in the evening, and then the next morning, in seclusion, working. And I thought that if that's the sort of life being a writer was, then that's the life of me, that I would become a writer. And so I started writing a book, and after the first page or two, I found it was fun. And I was at it every day, and I hadn't seen Mr. Anderson in 3 or 4 weeks. And I met Ms. Anderson on the street one day. She said, "We haven't seen you in a long time. What's wrong? Are you mad at us?" I said, "No, ma'am, I'm writing a book." And she said, "Good Lord." I saw her later, and she said, "I told Sherwood you're writing a book. He says, do you want him to read it?" I hadn't thought of anybody reading. I said, "Well, if he wants to, he can." She said, "Well, he told me he would make a trade with you. If he don't have to read that manuscript, he'll tell his publisher to take it." I said, "Darn." And so he told his publisher to take it. That's how I became a writer.
Which book was that?
That was one called Soldier's Pay, the first one. That was back in 1922, I believe.
To what
extent can a professional writer call his own shots?
Do you feel that
the
publisher,
sensing
what
you
publicly expect you to write, puts pressure on you to write a certain way?
In my case, there's never been any pressure. Never been any pressure at all. I have written manuscripts which before they were done, I myself decided were not good enough and burned them up. There have been other manuscripts which I would send to the public. He'd say, "For certain reasons, we can't print this." So I would keep it until times changed, and then he would say, "We can print it now," or send it to him. But there's never been any pressure on me. I've either had the best publishers, or maybe some providence watched over me and kept me from getting into trouble. But there's never been any pressure on me, and I think that is what makes the fiction writer, the poet's life, the best one, because he is his own man or woman. Nobody tells him what to do or say. If you're a dramatist, then you've got to compromise with actors, with directors, and with the public, with whoever puts up the money for it. But the writer is probably the only person alive who can be completely individual to do exactly as he wants to do.
I saw something not long ago that took Sound and Fury in 4 sections, and tried to draw a parallel between the id and ego and superego and the author's person. And don't you think that's indicative of what a lot of critics and scholars are doing, with not only you, but with contemporary writers making psychological inferences and finding symbols that the author never intended?
Well, I would say that the author didn't deliberately intend, but I think that in the same culture, the background of the critic and of the writer are so similar that a part of each one's history is the seed which can be translated into the symbols which are standardized within that culture. That is, the writer don't have to know Freud to have written things which anyone who does know Freud can divine and reduce into symbols. And so when the critic finds those symbols, they are of course there. But they were there as inevitably as the critic should stumble on his own knowledge of Freud to discern the symbol.
Well,
but I think the writer is primarily concerned in telling about people in the only times he knows, which is out of his experience, his observation, and his imagination. And the experience and the imagination and the observation of a culture or all the people in that culture partake of it, of the same three things, more or less. The critic has a valid part in any culture. I think that it might be a good thing if most writers like me and didn't bother to read him. That is, the writer knows what is in his book, and he knows whether it failed or didn't fail. And so it's possible that reading the criticisms could do a young writer harm, because it could confuse him. It could get him to think in terms of the symbolism which the critic, who's usually a good deal more erudite than the writer, can find in his work.
Mr. Baldwin, what was your reaction to the big production of Requiem for Nun?
I didn't get to see it. It was a gala night, and there was so much running back and forth. That was the day that Makarios was freed by the British, which was the first day that the British ambassador could come out on the streets of Athens at night, and so there was a good deal of a celebration, so much of being hauled around from one ambassadorial box to another and then having to go backstage, and so I didn't get a chance to see the play. I just saw scraps and fragments of it. Yes, ma'am. If you break it down into syllables, it's not too difficult. YAKNAPATHAPHA, Yaknapatawpha. It's a Chickasaw word meaning water runs slow through the flatland. Water flows slow through the flatland. It didn't take too long to write it. It started out as a short story and then grew. The obscurity in a writer's work is the writer's fault. It comes from a very, very valid reason to him. It's the sense, the foreknowledge of death which everyone has. The writer has been stricken with the passion and beauty of life, the world, and a demon-driven need to express that, to put it down on paper or cut it into marble, into music. And with that foreknowledge that he has only a limited time to do it, he may be dead tomorrow, he's got to do it all while he can still breathe. And it's a desire, a need to put the whole history of the human heart into every word, every paragraph that he writes. And the obscurity comes from a belief which I hold that there is no such thing as wars. That is, that every man at any moment in any action of his life is the sum of his whole past. And to show that man in a book or story intact and whole, the long thread of his past has got to be implied or inferred or suggested. And I haven't yet found any simple method to do that. The obscurity is not deliberate. I hate that obscurity as much as any reader, but I haven't found a better way yet to do it.
I wondered too, as I've noticed, evidences of characters in the talking about the dog and her dad. I think that was one of your short stories.
Yes.
I wondered whether this comes from a study of mental instability or observation, or is it imagination? For instance, an idiot. How can people know how these mental processes work?
One can't, of course. To the writer, is a part of the tragic yet immortal human condition. Though, of course, there are not as many idiots in Mississippi as are in my books, probably. but there are some, and since there are some, that is a fact, a verity in the tragic and beautiful human condition. Though the novelist is not trying to preach or deliver a message, he is showing to anyone that will take the trouble to read that there is pity, there is injustice, there are things in man's condition which should be changed, should be rectified, and if not that, should be looked on with pity and compassion, which is a part of beauty too. The capacity for compassion, for pity, is to me just as splendid as the capacity to be brave, heroic. And the capacity, the failure, which is baseness and sin, have just as much need for compassion as the mentality which is bad. That if one is to change man's condition, one must believe in the verities of not only baseness but and bravery, but of compassion too. Never to judge.
Does it give the author as much pain as it does the reader to produce scenes such as when Patty wanted to see her baby and Jason just drove by?
Yes, it does. But that's the writer is not simply dragging that in to pull a few tears. He is he puts that down as an instance of man's injustice to man. That man will always be unjust to man, yet there must always be people, men and women, who are capable of the compassion toward that injustice and the hatred of that injustice, and the will to risk public opprobrium to stand up and say, this is rotten, this stinks, I won't have it. No, nobody does. Because nobody believes that he deserves pity.
Mr. Bob, how do you feel about the Negro in the South?
Well, that's a big question. Could you be a little specific? The Negro is a part of our economy in our southern traditions. It's true anywhere, Virginia, Mississippi, or Texas. The white southerner loves Negroes as individual Negroes, but he don't like Negroes in the mass, as apart from the northerner who in theory loves the Negroes in the mass, but he's terrified and frightened of individual Negroes. I think that is a... The condition of the Negro in the South has got to be changed for the simple reason, two simple reasons. One is that there's 17 million of him now. He is diffused over the country to where he can be a political factor anywhere. And also, if we are to cope with a culture which says that man is of no importance as measured, matched against the state, if we are to cope with that and be successful, we ourselves have got to have a culture in which any man is of infinite importance, much more important than the state. And we can't have 17 million second-class citizens in a culture like that and have anybody believe it. But it's a slow process. It will take a great deal of patience and good sense. But it must be done. Yes, sir.
Do you believe immigration has a mind that Supreme Court will come to Mississippi anytime or near future or future?
It won't become into Mississippi or anywhere else because of any decision of any court. That's something that's got to be settled by people. But yes, I think that that whether integration may possibly never come in the sense that people think of it. I think that equality for the Negro will come. I think if the Negro has political equality to vote, if he has economic equality, if he has educational equality, then he won't want to mix with white folks, and more than white folks want to mix with him. Because I can't imagine any Negro after his experience with white folks wanting to be that close to him. But he will get equality if it's given to him by a Supreme Court new case enforced with police. As soon as the police are gone, then some smart white man, or even smart nigger, will take his equality away from him. He has got to be taught the responsibility of equality. That the Constitution never said everybody is to have happiness. They want to have the right to gain happiness if they could. And happiness or freedom is something that you've got to work for. If it were not to be worked for, it wouldn't be worth having. It's got to be worked for and defended. Who is the Irish member of Parliament said, "Man, God hath vouchsafed man liberty only under condition of eternal vigilance, which condition, if he break it, servitude is the consequence of his crime, the punishment of his guilt." Well, that's true of anyone. You can't have freedom unless you deserve it and work to keep it. That's an equality, of course, is freedom. None of them are good enough for me. They all fail. The one that I love the best is the one that made the most splendid failure, which is The Sound and the Fury. That's the one I worked at the hardest. But none of them are good enough, which is why I wrote another one this year, and I'll write another one next year, and I have every intention of living to be about 100 years old, still trying to write a book. Of course I won't, but I'll still try. Didn't work for either one seriously because that is not my bent, for the reason I stated that in either one it is a matter of compromise, with the actor, with the director, and mainly with the people that put up the money. It's so expensive, a TV show or a moving picture show. I've had a great deal of fun working for moving pictures because I like the people I worked with, but I never took working for any of them seriously. It was just a pleasant way to get a check every Saturday night to me. Yes, ma'am.
I would like to know what you think of
Henry Wright,
the writer. What is your
opinion about him? He is a man who has never betrayed his integrity, which one accepts to be a writer. He learned early in life a method by which he could do his work. He's never veered from that method. It suited him. He handled it well. If his work continues, then it's going to get better. His last book, I think, The Old Man and the Sea, was the best because he discovered something which he had never found before, which was God. Up to that time, his people functioned in a vacuum. They had no past. But suddenly, in The Old Man and the Sea, he found God. There was the big fish. God made the big fish that had to be caught. God made the old man that had to catch the big fish. God made the sharks that had to eat the fish, and God loved all of them. And if his work goes on from that, then it will still be better, which is something that not all writers can say. Too many tragically write themselves out too young, and then their lives are unhappy. That happened with Fitzgerald, happened with Sheldon Anderson. And so they go to pieces. Not actually. I think that all writers, or maybe all people, as they get older, they read less and less. The books I read now are the books that I read and loved when I was 21 years old. Unless someone puts the book in my hand and says, "Read this," then I read it. so I'm not too familiar with the work of the young writer nowadays. Young writers come to see me and talk to me, and so I know more young writers than I know their work. Yes, sir. Steinbeck, to me, has probably not done his best work so far. He's a better reporter than he is a novelist. And I think maybe his best work is still to come. Don Quixote, Son of Conrad, Heart of Darkness, The Nigger of the Narcissus, most of Dickens, The Brothers Karamazov, Anna Karenina, Madame Bovary, the Old Testament. I suppose I have about 50 that I read. I go in and out like you go into a room to meet old friends, to open the book in the middle and read for a little while, and I imagine over the course of every 10 years I would have read all of them through. Yes, sir.
Are these books then indicative that the authors who have written them, the people who have had the most influence on you as a writer?
I think that any writer is influenced by every word he ever read in his life, from the telephone book up and down, that he himself cannot say what book influenced him at what time. It may be if he went back over his work, he could pick out pages, scenes, and could see the derivation, but he never has time to do that because by that time he's busy writing another book. Actually, as I've said before, one virtue in being a writer is that every time you finish a book, that's one book you'll never have to read. You're finished with that. But I'm sure that any writer is influenced by everything that he has read, by everything he has seen. He is completely immoral. He will take what he needs from any source, but then he is willing to reciprocate that anyone after him can take what they find in his work that they can use. But he'll have no compunction about stealing right and left. Not deliberately, but it's his storehouse, and when he needs it, he uses it.
This pertains then to both ideas and techniques of writing.
Well, ideas in the sense of learning how people behave. I think that he doesn't bother about taking the abstract ideas of other writers, because unless that abstract idea fits some character which he himself feels that he's invented, then he will take it. But the fiction writer is not too interested in ideas any more than he's very interested in facts. That he's interested in people, in man and his the infinite variety of his mutations and his struggles and comical errors and tragic mistakes and his successes, his hopes, not in his ideas, but in his eternal conflict with himself, with his fellows, or with his environment. That's what the fiction writer's writing about. It takes a philosopher to write about ideas. And most writers have been so busy scribbling from childhood that they never had time to get much schooling, to know much about ideas.
Mr. Faulkner?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, Sherwood Anderson appears, and it seems to feel that there has been no clash except for the meaning. And I wonder to what extent you have grown in that philosophy or ideas?
Well, I'm sure if I ever read Virgil, I can't remember whether I did or not, I've stolen from him too, for the reason that the writer is influenced by everything he ever read. But I don't think that as long as the writer is busy writing, he's got time to make any didactic statements about where culture stopped and where it didn't stop. That he's not really interested in culture or even interested in literature until he writes himself out and he has been corrupted by books so much that he has nothing else to do with his time save to take up being a literary man. Most writers are not literary men. They're really their craftsmen.
Didn't you believe that Mr. Eliot underestimates his cultural character?
No, no, that he's perfectly, I'm perfectly willing for him to have his opinion, but to me, I ain't interested in it. That would probably be the worst day the writer ever faces, because then nothing remains but to cut his throat. I think that he would, the only way to express it is what Hemingway means by saying to feel good. He finishes the job and there's nothing that is still dangling, nothing more he wants to do to it. It's finished, it's complete. As long as it fails, there's always something you think, now if I could just go back and do this over, I could do it better. But you know that's a waste of time. The best thing is to take a new story. I don't think that anything scientists can cook up in a laboratory is going to do away with man. That's when this...